So this talk is about encountering suchness. I'm sorry I'm wearing the mask. I'll try to enunciate a little extra today. Had a cold this week and it's been stickier than I had hoped. The other thing that we forgot during announcements is that next week, Sunday, is the term opening ceremony. And so put a little thought into your term vow for the next 3 months, over the next week, because that'll be part of the term opening ceremony on Sunday. Part of being sick, there's a little similarity to, like, in terms of like the simplification of life. And I'm noticing a little sliding into sesshin that's happening. This talk is probably going to be a little more like a teisho than a Sunday Dharma talk, a little shorter, a little more direct pointing. Yesterday we had the Dharma cloud day, when the various affiliate groups all came here to spend the day together, get to know each other. Those are places that are facilitated by people who trained here, became teachers, and then moved on, each in a different context. And I gave a little talk as part of that on the importance of lineage, and quoted the line from the Kyoji Kaiman, "For they in the past were as we are now, and we will be as they in the future." And I also quoted that on Wednesday night, speaking about contrition. So this makes that a hat trick. It's always been a meaningful line for me. It's such a simple, hopeful, inclusive statement. I feel the acknowledgement of all the haste, the discomfort, the distraction, right? And the absorbing of all of it into practice. There is a way. One thing I've always appreciated about Buddhism is that it's really quite practical. I'm not someone who gets easily fascinated by theory. I don't want to talk about it. I want to get to it. And that, you know, that sentiment shows up in a lot of Zen stories. This is it. Panchi Sosan's, bring it to me and I will absolve you. Dai Doshin's, who is binding you? Bijang's, not knowing is most intimate. Like, again and again and again, there's that, what's immediate? What's right here? That is the way forward. In Dogen's fascicle Inmo, he uses a Chinese proverb, if you fall down because of the ground, you have to get up using the ground. The truth is always right here. Of course, it being Dogen, he leverages that proverb and explores falling down and getting up using space as well, emptiness as well. Don't get stuck on one way to do it. Stay nimble, stay pliable to the requests of the moment. The mind that is not malleable is impatient. Time and space feel tight and confining. That mind depends on activity, staying occupied primarily with identity. So that's a way to move through the world. It's characterized by suffering and disharmony. And I think, you know, like, everyone here is very familiar with what that's like. It's useful to be familiar with that. It's useful to investigate that as pattern, right? As reactivity, as conditioning. It's not, despite how it feels, who you are. Who we are, essentially, is still and vast. who we are is easy and expansive awareness. So different from the frantic ping pong of habit energy. React, fix, defend, explain, right? One way of talking about who we are, what we are, when we're easy and expansive, is suchness. Suchness is the world exactly as it is, simply as it is. Sometimes we can meet our life as clear liquid, without any hint of push or pull, without any hint of affixing, distracting. That's the opposite of what I was describing before with a mind that's frantic, that's impatient, that's not malleable. If we're still enough, there's no diffraction, there's no separation. And the beauty, the significance, the benevolence embedded in the moment are striking. That's real. When a sense of self does not intervene between the staccato play of events, places, tasks, and luminosity, that's our experience of suchness. Even though we're essentially, what we're essentially noticing is emptiness, it's a profoundly positive experience. We encounter it as hopeful, as blissful. So a moment like that is confirming of our insight into impermanence, into interdependence, non-self. It grounds and supports it. It allows it to penetrate more deeply. Suchness itself isn't localized. It's not bound. You don't have to be on sesshin or wait for 10 years of meditation to accrue or get this one particular task off your plate before you can encounter it. It's less conditioned and more universal than that. And it has to be perceived. We do have to access it. There are degrees of accessing it, right? We can talk and think our way into it to some degree. That's the weakest. And Zen largely discourages that approach. Remembering and invoking a prior experience of it is also on the low end, but there's some real utility there. I definitely make use of that. And there's varieties of direct experiencing that have different durations and intensities, some of which are life-changing. On the more thorough end of the spectrum are experiences of complete non-duality, of dissolution of things like time, space, perception. And those kinds of experiences tend to require a more specific set of circumstances to happen. Having experiences like this of luminosity, of suchness, of non-duality, isn't other, right? These experiences are actually how it is. It's the most natural way to experience our life. We get to. And to some extent, we kind of have to. Otherwise, like, we're just leaving so much treasure on the table. With that privilege is some measure of obligation. And we will be as they in the future, right? In order to encounter life in this way, we practice. We put in effort and intent in shaping how we perceive, how we behave. We gain leverage over our reactions and conditioning. We shape the structure of our life so that it supports this encounter with life such as it is. It all basically spills forth from the precepts. If this, then that. I mentioned Dogen's fascicle Inmo. Inmo means such as it is. Literally, it's what or it or that, referring to something that can't be or doesn't need to be explained. And so, as Buddhism took root in China, Chinese translators used that as a way to describe the ineffable. So it's Dogen's treatment of suchness. And in it, he quotes several ancestors and breaks down their attempts to explain suchness. He starts with Hungo Doyo's poem. If you want to get such a thing, you should be such a person. Since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? It's similar to a nay in the past, whereas we are now, and that it's affirming a path, a method. But it's adding a layer, pointing out that it's not a linear path. The finish line isn't over there in the garden, in the future. It's immediate. It's ongoing. What is a person such as this? What such of person are we aspiring to? How confining or liberating is that? Dogen reminds us that the bare mind also does not stand still, but comes and goes in pieces. Though there may be truth in it, it is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the self. He describes several different ancestors who are involved in stories about wind and things being moved by it. Usually there's a group of practitioners arguing, is it the bell, is it the wind, is it a banner, is it the wind? And then the winning answer is, usually by one of our ancestors, is that, nope, it's the mind moving. Not the wind, not the bell, not the banner. Stillness counts. Something about stillness, fixation and absorption are two different pathways of by which our attention is focused. Right? So concentration is a matter of the frequency. This is an Abhidharma thing here. It's the frequency with which attention lands on the same subject over a period of time. So if we're more concentrated, the mind is spending more time, more consecutive moments on the same subject. And we tend to colloquially talk about that as a virtue, but really it's value neutral. You could be quite concentrated as you rob a bank. It's a tool, and it depends on how you use it. So fixation is karmically mediated, and it's kind of relentless. It's active and conceptual. Absorption may be directed, or maybe it may have a creative quality to it. It may have some activeness, but it's not the same kind of activity. It doesn't feel like acceleration. It feels like landing. Another way to pull them apart is that fixation pulls, absorption centers. Or with fixation, what we're part of that activity is that we're relating a bunch of different things to that subject. Whereas in absorption, the other things are dropping away. The subject is all that's remaining. Everything else kind of recedes. So the path that Dogen is describing here is one of relaxing that compulsion to follow the ping pong, to attend to that frantic game of identity and conditioning, to soften the tendency to tunnel vision in on the tightest bit where the loudest content is. And if we can do that, we can be aware of that broader field, the stillness that that content takes place in. It's hard because it's very easy for awareness to identify with what it lands on. This is subtle. We've practiced that maneuver most of our life. And we're all here on a Sunday. We're also practicing a much more subtle trick of receiving suchness, maintaining awareness of that essential nature of ease, of spaciousness, of stillness, while engaging in direct perception, opting out of getting pulled into identification with the subject. This doesn't mean not doing anything, right? Stillness and activity is an illusory duality. There's lots to do. There's lots of important needs to be met. And it might mean doing less in particular ways. One way that I've been shaped by this practice is I have acquired much more trust in the arising of skillful means if I land in stillness. Like that the frantic ping-pongy self does not want to wait. It feels more urgent. And like it's just less credible. I really believe in the progression from cease from usable to do only good. The conditioned mind is anxious about the temporal relational opportunity passing, right, of not being enough. And the expansive mind is nourished by the benevolence, by the bliss, and is willing to be aware until action naturally arises. That pause is variable, right, in length of time, but also in magnitude of impact. Sometimes the weight of that stillness is kind of trivial, conceptual. But other times, it's glacial, it's galactic. It's a lot of leverage that might be available if we can trust and melt, if we can be absorbed in such as it is. We're here because we want to be such a person. We see the suffering in the world and we want to help. Please partake of this leverage so that we can help in a way that truly matters.
If you are in the room and have a question, please raise your hand and state your name. Please hold the microphone close to your mouth. If you are on Zoom, you can type your question into the chat or you can type your name into the chat and our co-host Hannah will unmute you so you can ask your question. My name's Mess. Why is Zen so confusing?
You don't have to keep it straight.
Great.
The self which wants to keep it straight is the one that gets confused. The one that's directly meeting it is not getting confused.
Hi, this is Jiu. I was reflecting on my time with practice and the energy I brought to it in the earlier years where it was, and to be honest, quite a lot of the later years, where there's a sense of trying, getting, having. And it wasn't until I allowed myself to think with a different framework that some stuff opened up. And one aspect of it that I found really helpful and unique to Buddhism is thinking of the mind as a sense and like not as this grand thing to be defended or created, but like it's just like hearing, it's just like seeing. And
I agree. I think the like part of what happens when we really see mind as like it's causal, like it's just like, you know, light waves are bouncing off rods and cones, and you know, neurotransmitters are being absorbed and uptaked here and released there, and like it's there you go, like you can diagram it, and the same thing is happening. We just haven't, we're not as sophisticated in describing it, but we can see like that, how like chunk it is. And as we do that, like we're less fooled by that, you know, the projection of identity.
This is Colleen. I also resonate with that line, they in the past were as we are now and we will be as they in the future. It's a favorite. What comes to mind for me right now is that I feel like I can meet those moments. I feel pretty confident in meeting those moments and having that perception. And there's something outside of me that's very frantic. I mean, life is just very frantic now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for me, life is more frantic now than it was 10 years ago. And you know, work life is like that. And I can be like that at work and like, okay, I'm meeting this moment and then I've got to shift to something else. And I guess I feel a little bit like I'm making an excuse or something, but like, it's not like sitting and having a cup of tea. And I don't know. Yeah. It's just, there's just something. And I feel like, think the ancestors weren't quite as frantic as we are.
I don't know. Like, yeah, we look around and like there's some pretty dire circumstances, but like, oof, there's been some pretty dire circumstances through history. And I guess like the human realm is supposed to have the right amount of suffering that we are motivated to practice, and but practice is available, like it's, we can access it. It's not too much suffering. And so like we can quibble over like, you know, the degree, but like we know we're in that wedge, like we're in that zone where like, okay, this is viable. And I think that's enough.
Hi, this is Genko. So when you started talking about being such a person, the line that came up for me was at the end of Fukan Zazengi. It says, continue to live in such a way and you will be such a person. Mm-hmm. So that gets back into practice and actually the precepts, of course, about how to live in a particular way. I like what you said about when you can find that place of stillness, which is, seems like it's different from that franticness that you're talking about, that sort of frantic life. And it seems like a lot of our practice has to do with finding that, place of stillness. And what I tell people when I'm teaching meditation is, this is kind of an artificial environment here. And so we're trying to create a place where you can you can experience that, where you can understand, or you kind of, if you can experience it, then it's a little easier to access later under other circumstances. And that kind of works. I still have those times when I get just completely caught. Yesterday I was just going and going and going, and I kept doing the same thing over and over, and I saw myself doing it and I couldn't seem to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So that still happens, darn it. but But it doesn't have to. I know that it's not going to last forever. I just know this. So at some point things will change and yeah. I can get through it and be fine.
Yeah, I think what I would say there is I'm wary about like the place of stillness, or because like it's like it is so ephemeral, right? Like we have complicated lives, and what we are experiencing is constantly changing. And I want to I don't want that to be a impediment. I want that to be that's actual. That's exactly what we're doing, and I want to choose that and be wholehearted about that, and like celebrate it. And when we find a place of stillness within ourselves, it's that moment, right? Like we may have several of them, you know, in a chunk of time, but it's not who we are. Like it's just an experience, just like any other. It's the sense happening, and I there's something refreshing about we don't get anything from it. We don't get to take anything. There's no laurel we put on our head. I got suchness today, you know. Oof, it's gone.
Yeah. We have a question from.
Oh, Julia's a ventriloquist.
Okay, this is Tony. Can you speak to the role of equanimity in finding that place of stillness? What I've been finding recently is what's coming up more and more is the ability to just let stuff go.
Yeah.
Whatever this is in Zazen, just whatever comes up. I used to, fret about it, chase after it, try to get rid of it, the usual stuff one does. And the just a greater and greater ability to just quietly just let it go. And I think that is equanimity, and that even if it's not stillness, there may be a difference there. It's pretty good anyway, right? Put it that way.
Yeah. So I think that's a great point. The noticing where attention is landing in the meditation can be a push-pull. Like it can be grasping after, not having anything show up, and it can be pushing away thoughts that appear. And if that's mostly what's happening, it's not counterproductive, but it's it could be more productive. I don't like productive as the word there, but whatever, I'm conditioned to. I think I recognize what you're saying, Tony, and that's my experience as well, is that I think that's part of what I was talking about of before, we don't have to get something from it. This isn't an acquisitive endeavor. We're not trying to get suchness or get enlightenment. We're meeting our actual experience without reservation, wholeheartedly. And if we're doing that through the filter of attachment, of identity, it's not wholehearted. Something's withheld, something's pushed on there.
Yeah. So if I could sum it up, it's as though the best bit is not wanting. Not wanting is the best bit. It's, all by itself. Anyway, all right, thank you.
Hi, this is Julia. And this is kind of a funny follow-up to that. I like ping pong, and I also like tacos, and my question is can you play ping pong and eat tacos inside of suchness?
Oh, I hope so. But I would say how I gave that spectrum of suchness of how we might experience it. You're probably not doing that at the higher levels, right? like there's, you know, like you can be absorbed in playing ping pong and eating tacos, even at the same time, I imagine. Ping pong might suffer, I don't know. But and like there are breakthrough moments, and there's also layers which aren't, you're not going to hit there. That's my experience of it.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah. There's a fair amount of hands right now.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I was wondering if you could speak on, like, I'm struck by the past and future kind of dissolving a little in that moment. And particularly the future. I'm thinking about, like, not just letting go of future outcomes, but actually, like, trusting the future.
So when you're saying past and future, like, were you referencing something that I was saying, or is that kind of part of your, what you're...
Well, I think so, but the beginning that we are as...
Oh, gotcha. Okay, thank you. Now I'm with you. Yeah. Well, I think that sort of resonates with Tony's equanimity piece, right? Of like... I feel like this is what I'm talking about is optimistic. Like there's kind of a hopefulness, but like it's not graspy, right? It's not, I really hope. Like it's really open and kind of undefined. And like allowing. I think that's probably a useful stance in relation to the future.
Would you say that the suchness is an expression of the past and an expression of the future?
No. I would say that like suchness is bigger than past and future. Yeah. Is primary too.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're getting into the weeds a little bit there, but I'd stand by that.
Hi, this is Ruby. Kind of to add to that, I saw this study that there was like in quantum physics, time isn't linear and like the past, your actions in the present can affect like your action in the past, and it's like real, like you can get like really confusing in that. And I was like, is that time kind of like related to suchness that like you can exist in it in different moments, but it's never like really, you can never really exist in it forever?
Well, I'm not going to try to answer that from like a physics perspective, but from like an experiential perspective, I would say that like time is a really helpful heuristic. It's a really useful way of helping us make sense of the world. And like there are times when it doesn't count. It doesn't like fit the situation where our quality of awareness is such that like it's not relevant, and so the whole past, present, future thing breaks down.
Okay, I'm still kind of confused, but okay.
That's fair. Roka.
I'm Roka. Thank you, Kakamyu. As you were giving your talk, I was thinking about some where I am, meeting the moment. I've experienced trauma last year, and from a relationship. And I'm feeling it's been ongoing getting to understand. I'm feeling nervous system, body things that are unfamiliar. And so the shares today, like about our mind and the mind is a sense. And so I'm just working with nervous system, where my nervous system is, meeting it where it is. And when you spoke of allowance, that's something that resonates to for me to just be with it as it is, meeting the moments that I can. It's sometimes it feels like pain, sometimes it feels like suffering when I'm maybe getting even carried away with it. But it's just something, it's just a different kind of, for me, it's just a different kind of experience.
Yeah, I think I really underestimated how much trust this takes. And like I really wanted to be able to do it through willpower and cleverness. Right? Like I wanted to lean on my strong suits. And it's not like that. It's not how you turn the wheel. And trust is really important. And part of what we're trusting is our own Buddha nature, that like we do have really profound wisdom about how this works and what we need and what's next. We just like we have to practice how we access that. And coming to stillness, touching non-attachment, releasing into equanimity, allowing it to arise is part of that.
I'm Guy. Thank you for your talk. I hope you'll bear with me. This seems probably pretty random, but I have a feeling that there is something that we could learn from hostage negotiators here. Maybe a Zen student or even a Zen master, because I was thinking about the gentleman who's rather well known who describes his methods as a FBI hostage negotiator of many decades. And he has a couple of techniques that he describes. One is mirroring. Everybody is probably familiar with this, where you don't push away the emotions that are coming forward, but you empathize and even reflect them back without amplifying them. And then that way you're not invalidating, you know, a sense of urgency that is there, which is real, but welcoming it. But then at the same time, you can use something that this negotiator, he refers to as the late night DJ voice. Late night DJ voice. And it's a way to maybe ease yourself into, or ease the other, you know, yourself can also be the other.
Yeah.
Into a into this suchness, maybe.
Well, yeah. I would say, like, if that's a, if remembering that is a useful reminder for you in terms of like, oh, maybe I need a little bit more of the late night DJ voice. Like, it's a like hint towards equanimity. It's a it can allow some acknowledgement of situation without like fixating. Great. You know, make use of that. I think it's, I think the tools are like it's how we use awareness, and so like that's one way of grabbing a handle onto it. Yeah. Any last one?
I was thinking about this is Suho. And I was thinking about your warning a little earlier in the Q&A about this place of suchness, right? There's this big place and there's fireworks. And I think I'm interested in maybe those smaller places of what does it feel like as we start to get traction, though? Like, how do we know? Like that faith and that trust that you're speaking to, you kind of said, everybody knows it in the room, but I'll bet you there's a few people going, oh, no.
I would say that we know it because there's a, like, we sense that it matters, right? Like it's significant in a way that we care about. There's a connection to sense of purpose, that it feels meaningful. That's prominent there. I think also, you know, it's pleasant, sure, also. There's a certain, like just reward to being in the vicinity of suchness. I think those two are what's most prominent. Thanks, y'all.